Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading Voices of Victory from the Army Benevolent Fund. Welcome to Voices of Victory, a special podcast from the Army Benevolent Fund, the Army's national charity, marking the 80th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day on the 8th of May, 1945. A date carved in history that drew a close to over half a decade of intense fighting in Europe, at sea, on the land, and in the air, costing the lives of nearly 384,000 British military personnel and almost 61,000 civilians, 44,000 of whom were killed on the Blitz alone. Later in the day, Sir Winston Churchill, Prime Minister and wartime leader of Britain, making his famous Viva Victory sign, addressed the joyous cries in Whitehall from the balcony of the Ministry of Health. "This is your victory," he said. "Victory of the cause of freedom in every land." In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Victory in Europe Day, when 5.5 years of bloody war in the West came to an end, and the nation parted throughout the land.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom in every land. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this.
Chelsea pensioner and celebrated singer Colin Thackeray, SMIG, 95, who began his boys' service at the age of 15 with the Royal Artillery in 1945, spent much of the war as an evacuee. He recalls listening with rapt attention to the Prime Minister's words on the family radio.
Everybody worshipped the Prime Minister in those days. Everything he said, every time he's on the radio, you didn't understand, you know, too young to understand all the words he was using. He's a great orator, and it was just his voice. And it's true, you know, it sounds a bit odd, I suppose, these days, but when we used to listen to his voice come over there, and it did inspire one.
So here we are, 15 years old, you've seen from 1939 to 1945, yeah, right the way through the war.
Yeah.
And you were still at school, and at 15 years old, your grandfather, it was your grandfather who signed the papers for you to join the army. And what's your recollection of VE Day itself, the 8th of May 1945?
Well, VE Day itself, because, you know, I was in Coventry there with my grandparents. We heard a lot of all the jollification going on. The recollections were basically was great relief to think that, you know, we didn't have to dodge bombs anymore, because I'd been in London all through the Blitz, people were going to come home and you're going to be very happy and all the stuff, you know, you think of at the time.
What's your recollection of the Blitz?
Well, Anderson shelters, you know, those were the little shelters you had indoors. Going down the tube to get away. Sirens, of course, as soon as the sirens went, up and went wherever you were going. I remember in our house, we had one of these, I think it was a Morrison. Yes, Anderson shelters were the round things out in the garden. Morrison shelters were indoor ones. It was like a huge, flat, iron, steel table you could underneath this thing. And we slept under there. So it became, it's a sort of norm, you know. It's going to school the morning after a raid and seeing what's happened. Seeing who got it, as it were. And it was a classic picture of a double-decker bus up on its boom end. We walked past that old waiter's school. So that was my recollection of that. But of course, the after the war, it didn't have to happen anymore. That was wonderful. Mm. Because we were left in bomb sites all over London.
For 2 days, Britain erupted in joyous celebration, joining the rest of the world in arguably the greatest party of all time. London, our capital city, was the place to be. Joyce Wilding, 100 years old, but then just 20, was serving with the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry at Brigand's House in Essex, the legendary Station 14, SOE's forgery and elite agent section.
It was the most joyous time or day that I'd ever encountered, or anyone. I mean, the actual day we had off, so we'd been near London, I drove up to London, I think there were four or five of us went up, and the first thing we did was to get into Piccadilly, and joined a crocodile, as you know, that was doing the hokey cokey or the pally glide down Piccadilly, and everyone was just singing, cheering. I remember masses of American soldiers climbing up lampposts. It was chaos, really, but joyous chaos.
And would it be fair to say, Joyce, did you dance all night long?
Well, I don't think we did all night long. We got home reasonably well, but after doing the dancing down Piccadilly, we went to the Mall in front of the palace, which was perhaps the most famous thing, when the King and Queen and the late Queen in uniform, because she was about my age, you know, and Winston Churchill came out on the balcony.
So were you singing, were you chanting, "We Want the King"?
Yeah, yes, and funny enough, I just recently met a wren that was there on the same day, and she said they were shouting. I can't actually remember them doing that, I do remember them wanting to see the King Queen, because they came out several times. But, it was just, we were going mad, I would say, because it's the first time, I think, that we felt there was a future in a way.
But as with all good parties, so the country woke up the following day with an enormous headache. For while there had been good cause for celebration at home, war in the East rumbled on. And there's plenty more still to worry about. Churchill biographer and historian Andrew Roberts talks about the issues the Prime Minister had to face.
He was aware of two things primarily to do with that. The first, of course, was that the whole of the Second World War itself was by no means over, and we had to concentrate on defeating the Japanese as quickly as possible. And the other thing, of course, was the situation in Europe was a very dangerous one. You had a massive refugee crisis with tens of millions of people having been displaced, and you had the essentially threat of communism if these major problems weren't dealt with in places like Italy and Germany and France. So it's a series of headaches, which is why actually on the morning of the 8th of May 1945, he spent the entire morning in bed working.
There's a land of begin again on the other side of the hill, where we'll learn to love and live again when the world is quiet and still.
After the long years of conflict, Britain was on her knees. The war had almost bankrupted the nation. Our cities were destroyed by bombing, and 4.5 million brave service personnel who fought our battles urgently needed somewhere to live and something to do. Historian Judy Summers.
I think the biggest issue the government had was how to demobilise nearly 4 million men efficiently and to clothe them. There's always the logistics. So clothing was terribly important. Every man had to have his demob suit, had to hand his old army surplus back. Then there was a question of what to do with foreign currency, how to deal with men who'd been in very unfavourable climes, susceptible to tropical diseases. That was a bit more after the Far Eastern prisoners of war came back. But there were lots and lots of questions about how to deal with the actual physical return of men. And the fact that many of the men had signed up at sort of 17, 18, some even younger. And if they'd been in the army for 5 years, that was their really their sole experience for the last half decade. And so the government had to work with the armed forces and discover whether it was possible to set up training programs for these men. And if they did set them up, would they be taken up? And so they had lots and lots of great programs, but the take up was very small because the sense was that people simply wanted to get home and start over. And I think the key thing to remember and to remind listeners in the Second World War is that it was a total war. And that means that everybody was involved. And so men came home to find that their wives, mothers, sisters, daughters, sons, fathers had had a very devastating at times experience. You know, children had been evacuated, women had had to work, a lot of homes had been destroyed. So they came back to a real sense of unease and uncertainty. There's a lovely fact, the post office recorded over the 6 years of the Second World War, 42 million changes of address. That is more changes of address than there were households in the UK in 1940.
It was precisely to manage the very pressing social problems that would be the cost of victory at home when the fighting was over that the Army Benevolent Fund, along with its sister service charities, was established by the government in 1944. But the charity needed cash to carry out its task. Leading the charge, Field Marshal Montgomery, in his usual blunt, frank and direct manner, appealed to the nation on the soldiers' behalf.
We owe a debt to these men and to the families of those who have fallen. Let us not forget that debt. We want £1 million. If every adult in Great Britain will give one shilling, we shall get that sum. I ask you sincerely to do all you can to help the soldiers and their families who have done so much for their country during the war and who now require help in the peace. I feel sure you will not let them down.
In 2 years, between 1944 and 1946, the Army Benevolent Fund gave out £500,000 in grants. That is the equivalent today of £28 million, roughly. There must have been an enormous, as you talk about, welfare headache that had been facing government since about 1944, when they were aware that the war was coming to an end. Can you sort of outline what that, the extent of that, how that mental headache must have been?
I mean, it must have been colossal for the government, because they'd been on a war footing really, honestly, since the mid-1930s. I mean, they'd been planning for the war, even though everybody had hoped it wasn't going to happen. So that's more or less a decade. And suddenly to switch to thinking about civilian problems was enough of a change. But the biggest problem Britain had was housing. Only 12% of married couples were able to live in their own homes. All the others had to have shared housing, and the housing stock had not been maintained for the last 6 years, so it was in very poor shape. And so that was one of the huge problems. And the other problem was how to feed people, because rationing carried on, as we know full well, until 1954, although it was lessened slightly over the sort of early years of the 1950s. But it was so serious, the food shortage, that they had to bring in bread rationing after the war, which hadn't been enforced during the Second World War. And of course, the 4 million plus men who'd been in the army, and the many hundreds of thousands of women who'd been in the armed services working, you know, hard behind the scenes, they all had been used to army rations, which were considerably better than what the general population had been surviving on. People like the Army Benevolent Fund had to step in when it wasn't possible for for people to make their own way, because there weren't the jobs, there wasn't the infrastructure, there wasn't the housing, and there wasn't the knowledge after 10 years of war planning of how to run a civil society. And it had to rely, the armed forces bringing home men had to rely very heavily on the Army Benevolent Fund, also on the Royal British Legion, to help out. And don't forget, they came home pre the setting up of the National Health Service. So in 1944, there was a sense that there was going to be some form of universal health, but it wasn't in place. And so a lot of the funding that you would have been doing was to be helping men to get hold of help for example, prosthetic limbs, for Hearing aids, that was a big issue. Who knew? But it was very important. Simple things like walking sticks and false teeth. They all needed to be purchased if they could be, and there simply wasn't the National Health Service around until 1948 to help those kind of minor but terribly important details come into place.
There are occasions when the population said enough, we can't put up with this, we must have better.
Yes, there were. So really interesting. After the First World War, accounts that you read were of jubilation, you know, school bells being broken because of the, you know, excitement of ringing them so loudly in 1918. After the Second World War, I think there was a real sense that people were just exhausted, Harry. They'd been under bombardment, not everywhere, but certainly in the big cities. They'd had and endured food rationing since 1940. They'd endured clothes rationing since 1941. They'd endured all sorts of shortages and hardships, and, you know, houses were cold, they couldn't be maintained. So it was a very uncomfortable place. And the optimism that was felt in 1918 wasn't felt in the same way in 1945 and 1946. And yes, there was unrest and there was a lot of anger. And I think that's why the Conservative government was thrown out in the general election, because Labour promised and indeed delivered, I have to say, big change. It brought in a good future for the working man and woman in Britain.
But that, I think, was the undernote throughout the war, was that in many ways the war was responsible for a greater awareness of equality, of women getting parity, of other ranks being acknowledged for their ability, and perhaps a dilution of the officer class, because it was such a team effort.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and particularly, if I may, in the case of the women, because the officer class didn't exist in the same way. It's interesting, if you look at recruitment, you could get in the WAF or the ATS, you'd get a duchess sleeping next to the daughter of a road sweeper, and indeed I've got proof that actually happened. So it was very, very mixed, and that was incredibly healthy for social mobility. But what happened after the war is all those women who had worked so hard, been involved in Bletchley Park as high profile, but worked in factories, you know, worked on all sorts of different projects, they were sidelined and they were told to go back to the home because the government had to provide jobs for the boys. And I think one of the least understood aspects of the Second World War was how very difficult it was for the women when the men came home, because not only were they sidelined and pushed out of their jobs and told by the grateful government, including Beveridge, to go back to the homes and build a family for the future, but they were also expected to deal with the men. And a lot of these men, as you know, had seen terrible things. Some had done terrible things or felt they'd done terrible things, and they'd been exposed to brutality and also regimentation of army life. And they came home and the women had the front door closed and the women had to cope. Some of them bumped along very happily, and others didn't. And there's a very high divorce rate after the Second World War because of the difficulty of adjustment.
Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot. But you remember, with advantages, what feats he did that day. And then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups, freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day till the ending of the world. But we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
Thus in Crispin's Day speech from Henry V, written by William Shakespeare, performed by Mark Rylance. But 8 years on, as living memory fades into history, along with other similarly once celebrated great victories like Agincourt, Trafalgar and Waterloo, what of VE Day today? Andrew Roberts.
Well, Churchill said on that day, in one of the several speeches that he made that day, but one of the major ones, the one from the Ministry of Health balcony, when he said, "This is your victory," and the crowd cried back, "No, it's yours." And he then said, "It's the victory of the cause of freedom." And it strikes me that 80 years on, the cause of freedom is still under great threat. When one looks to our potential adversaries, especially, of course, China and Russia, that one sees both of them on the march. It strikes me that V-Day is genuinely just as relevant as it's ever been, and I would argue much more relevant than it's been for many years.
Like Trafalgar Day, like Waterloo Day, like Christmas Day, do you think V-Day will be lost in time?
Well, do you know, I'm glad you mentioned those in particular, because at the moment, Trafalgar is only taught in 11% of British schools, Waterloo only in 11%, and Agincourt, you were making the great Shakespeare quotation about Agincourt, only in 18% of British schools, whereas other issues, important issues such as the slave trade, are taught in 99% of British schools, and there are various other, you know, important aspects of British history. The Glorious Revolution, 49%, for example, which is not bad, I suppose. But I do fear that if we don't tell the coming generations about what VE Day was and what it meant, then, and I'm not saying by any means, of course, that the Second World War isn't taught in schools, it is indeed, but we seem to sort of jump from Henry VIII to Hitler too quickly. We don't tell the long narrative arc of our island story to our future generations in the way that we ought to, in my view. And so I do fear that VE Day might go the way, especially when there's nobody left who personally remembers it, the way of Trafalgar and Waterloo and Agincourt, which it should not, because like those three battles that I just mentioned, they are epicentral to our understanding of who we are as a people.
Julie Summers.
I think VE Day represents a moment of great celebration, and I think we tend to forget that VJ didn't happen for another 3 months. It represents still today the complete destruction of Nazi ideology. And I think that still resonates. I mean, you mentioned the Second World War to anybody and they've heard of it and they know about it and they know about VE Day. It's a turning point. There's no two ways about it. And it's a watershed in history because we went from many long years of war into a troublesome period that ended up where we are today. And there's a sense that we have built over the last 80 years on the extraordinary generosity and courage of those people who fought the war for us.
First aid nurse at Newmarie and SOE veteran Joyce Wilding reflects on VE Day 80 years on.
80 years peace. What is your take, your view on the importance of VE Day 80 years on?
We had suffered, and people, the younger generations, really don't quite know what we had to go through, such as air raids, the bombings and blackouts. It was really quite worrying and not a happy time, you know, with air raids. I felt that was all over. You know, it wasn't good because we still had rationing, and really it was quite difficult, I think, for the young men to come home.
5 years after VE Day in 1945, Chelsea pensioner Colin Thackeray would himself see active service in the Korean War with the Royal Artillery. A singer since early childhood, he would perform I Vow to Thee, My Country as part of the 80th anniversary celebrations on Thursday evening, the 8th of May.
On the 8th of May,
2025, you will be singing "I Vow to Thee, My Country," the national celebrations. What will you be thinking at that very special moment?
I should be thinking about those days, because it's a significant song, because I did vow myself to my country, I sang a bit, my thoughts about it, and when I'm rehearsing it now, because I rehearse it in the other room now, I think about singing it the first time I sang it in public, which was after winning Britain's Got Talent. I went to the Royal Command performance. I sang it there. It was William and Kate, Bridge William. And they were in the roll box at the time, so I was singing to them with a group of pensioners behind me, and there was a magic occasion. And it's a song that I feel, I don't sing it just because it's a song, it's a song with significance. At this time there are plans, Joe knows all the details. There are plans for me to sing it at the top of Tower Bridge. And they do say, the people organise it, you will lead the country singing this. Well, it'd be lovely.
Marvellous. What a special occasion.
Yes, absolutely.
I vow to thee, my country, all earthly things above, and time perfect the service of my love, the love that asks no question, the love that stands the test, that lays upon the altar the dearest and the best. Falters, the love that pays the price, the love that makes undaunted the final sacrifice.
VE Day signifies peace, a respite from the horror and tragedy of war that we as a nation have enjoyed for 80 years. The war to end all wars has at times in history been the popular battle cry of the political classes. But a quirk of history is its nasty habit of moving in cycles. Old wounds run deep as new fester and less tended to. Julius Summers looks to the years ahead. VE Day signifies peace, a respite from the horror and tragedy of war that we as a nation have enjoyed for 80 years. The war to end all wars has at times been the popular battle cry of the political classes. But a quirk of history is its nasty habit of moving in cycles. Old wounds run deep as new fester unless tended to. Julius Summers looks to the years ahead. Julius Summers looks to the years ahead.
I'm trying to be optimistic because I'm naturally an optimistic person. But I think if my grandfather, who had fought in the Second World War, could see where we are today, he would feel we were in a very, very difficult position. What I think people will still do is to look back on how very effective the Allies were in crushing the Nazis in the end, at the end of the Second World War. So there is always going to be a story there. And the thing is, we are by our nature people who live by stories. You know, I'm a historian. The trick is in the word story in history. And I think people will go on telling those tales. And I meet young people nowadays, when I'm going to give lectures in schools and things, who know what their great-great-grandfathers did. They know they were at Arnhem, or they were in Al Alamein, or they were fighting the Battle of the Bulge. They know these things. And although they can't link to them directly like you and I can to our grandparents or even parents in some cases, there is a sense that it's very much part of our history.
Britain today is a very different place than it was in 1945. If the emergency came again, do you think the nation would rise to the call?
Yes, I have absolutely no doubt about it in my mind whatsoever. I think people are fundamentally courageous. They are determined. I see in amongst my friends here in Oxford the reaction to the situation in Ukraine. I'm not going to badmouth anybody, but there is a very strong sense that actually we have to stand together. And I think people would be very brave. And I know that from my own children who are in their 20s. They would be absolutely the first to sign up.
Historian Andrew Roberts.
It does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, that the events of the last few months have undermined things that we've believed in since 1945. Well, that we've believed in since much earlier than that, but which we expected most of the rest of the what used to be called the free world, the civilised world, to believe in as well, such as that you don't accept a totalitarian dictatorship, redrawing the boundaries and frontiers of Europe by force. And that was something that we didn't accept when the Russians did it to the Baltic states in 1940. We certainly didn't accept it when Adolf Hitler tried it from 1939 onwards. And so it is it's a worrying development that we are no longer living in a world where we can take it entirely for granted that that should be the case.
The Army Benevolent Fund salute the brave veterans of that greatest generation who so selflessly fought for the freedom we enjoy to this day. Long may it last. And in so doing, we say thank you to each and every one of them for their service. For the last 80 years, the Army Benevolent Fund has safeguarded our soldiers, veterans, and their immediate families in times of need, so they can lead a life of independence and dignity for the service they've given for our liberty. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. If you enjoyed this programme and would like to learn more about the charity's work, then please visit armybenevolentfund.org. And my thanks to Lord Roberts, Judy Summers, Joyce Wilding, and Colin Thackeray for taking part in the programme. From me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening, and farewell.
I was singing this song. We meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Series editors are Jenny Ribbon and Natasha Theobald. with promotion and marketing by Lola Abdolina. Studio editing is by Michael Siliano. This has been a GameCube production for the Army Benevolent Fund.
This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin shall not go by from this day to the end.
Yes, line. Churchill was able to. Can I say that he was able to recite it a bit better than you are?